Into the Bad Quaker podcast, where liberty is our mission. Okay, now back to the series Beyond Civil Disobedience. This is part three, and we're talking about actions with purpose within the zero aggression principle. And I can't emphasize enough that we must stay within the zero aggression principle in all of these, all of our actions, all of our activity. I'm not going to do a lot of recap. Well, I'll do a little bit of recap. But one of the things that I really want to emphasize is in the difference between what is civil disobedience and what is not civil disobedience. It's imperative to understand. And this, like in the last two episodes on this topic, I talked about the Merriam-Webster's definition and about John Rawls, the scholarly, the guy who literally wrote the book on mainstream political philosophy. They make it very clear that civil disobedience is a symbolic or ritualistic violation of the law rather than a rejection of the system as a whole. Rawls considered civil disobedience within the scope of true law, not outlaw and not anarchist. So it's imperative to understand that the purpose of civil disobedience is to get the government to change, either through getting the public sympathy or through direct action with the government. One way or the other, civil disobedience is individuals directly attempting to change government. And what I'm talking about is going beyond that. So things like agorism, I'll get into that in a minute. Let's move on from there. Well, let me just say one more thing. Civil disobedience, in your mind, you should think of civil disobedience in the same category as things like voting, petitioning, lobbying, speaking at a town hall meeting, writing a letter to your congressman, giving political donations, volunteering for political campaigns. Civil disobedience is in that category. And to one degree or another, in different countries and different governments, they might allow more or less of that type of activity. But all of that activity is within the realm. It is within the same realm. Civil disobedience is right in there with voting and petitioning and lobbying and all those other things that you can do from a legal standpoint, as far as legal minds like John Rawls and others like that. So I'm not condemning anyone who peaceably engages in civil disobedience. And I have acknowledged in this series that civil disobedience can be very productive. It can be very useful. And I gave examples like Eddie Free's dance protest at the at Jefferson Memorial, and other protests like that can be very effective in drawing public attention to the silliness of some of the laws and rules and so forth. So I'm not condemning anyone for peaceably engaging in civil disobedience. But things like agorism, black markets, smuggling, prostitution, non-protest tax evasion, things like that, none of those are civil disobedience. They're not protests. There are ways of making money within the zero aggression principle, and you may not like some or most or any of those. You may not like them. You may feel that you wouldn't want to engage in those things. That's perfectly fine too. But all those are methods of making money that still follow the zero aggression principle that are outside of the law. That's totally different from civil disobedience or other things that might be considered within the realm of government. So then the principled anarchist has to find ways to insulate themselves from the evils of government while exposing the religion of the state. That's really the primary job of the anarchist. The vast majority of anarchist activism must be above ground. It must be providing for our families. It has to be producing wealth and working to educate those who can hear our arguments, those who who are sensitive to the overreach of government. These people that can be reached through things like logic and through moral arguments and so forth like this. This is our primary job as principled anarchists. But some anarchists are going to be driven from deep inside to go beyond just simple education. They're going to be driven to even go beyond agorism. They're going to be driven to go beyond civil disobedience. And they're going to want to actively fight. They're going to need to go underground to do that. And they're going to have this desire deep inside them to, you might say, to go full-on fight club with this thing. Now, this can be productive to our cause, but it has to be done according to wisdom and according to the zero aggression principle. Otherwise, it's counterproductive to our cause, and you're actually hurting things more than you're helping things. Now, there's going to come a time, and I don't know exactly when this is going to be, but there's going to be a time when we're going to be forced, a good portion of us are going to be forced to move beyond civil disobedience and beyond things like just simple education and talking. The time is going to come where we're going to be forced to take action. And now is the time, right now, when we prepare for that time. It's not here yet, maybe not here tomorrow or the next day, but the time is coming when we need to be prepared for a day when very large portions of us are going to have to be taking actions beyond civil disobedience. Now is the window that we can get this done in. Now is a wink in time where we have the opportunity to be prepared for that time that's coming. We need to establish perimeters of behavior, what can and cannot be done, what needs to be done, what shouldn't be done. We need to understand, not like laws among us, but we need to understand among us how we can do things and remain consistent to our philosophy, which is the zero aggression principle. And we need to establish well ahead of time systems of support so that we can accomplish these things in an efficient manner. We need funding, we need communications, and we need a cloaking ability. We need to be able to, you know, I've said before, we need to move in and out of the matrix according to our choice. We need to be able to move in and do things and step back out and then vanish and be away from it. We need to not, the people doing this kind of thing, this underground anarchism, this needs to be completely invisible. Not the results, but the people themselves doing the underground anarchism needs to be absolutely invisible to the public and to the government. You know, I mentioned Legos in the hall at nighttime, and the government is like this big dumb thing that gets up and walks to the bathroom at night and steps on the Legos. We need a Lego distribution network that can quietly and silently put those Legos in place for the government to step on. And I'm not really, I can't remember if I said this in the last episode or not, but I'm not really, you know, I'm using the phrase underground anarchist, but I'm not really comfortable with that phrase because I'm sure that there's like 10 million things on the internet that are called something like underground anarchist. So that's probably a phrase that's taken, and that's probably a phrase that already means 10 million other things to other people. So maybe something like what did I say a second ago? A Lego distribution network. Maybe that's a more effective name. But maybe somebody else has a better name. But either way, this idea of just placing Legos in the hall and letting the government trip down the stairs on them, that's really what we're looking to do. We have to adhere to the zero aggression principle. We have to reject collectivist thinking. We need to get it out of our head that we're here to, that, you know, that government is oppressing us, and so we're in a self-defense mode, and that justifies striking out against the government or against agents of the government. That's collectivist thinking. We have to reject that. That has to completely be off the table. Attacking agents of the government simply because they work for the government is off the table. That is a violation of the zero aggression principle, and it's collectivist thinking. You can't think that way. You don't think like the government thinks. You know, the government tells us things like, this is a legitimate target in reference to war or something like that. They'll say, well, this factory is a legitimate target because they make munitions there or whatever. Well, that was one of the justifications for the atomic bombs in Japan was, well, it's okay if we bomb these two cities full of civilians. because they make things there for the war effort. That was supposed that was a thinly veiled excuse for bombing Dresden. But of course that didn't work because it just so happened that they entirely didn't bomb the munitions manufacturing that was near Dresden, and then they did bomb the civilian population of Dresden, including the refugee camps. So, even though the government used that as an excuse, it was an empty excuse. But that's what the government teaches us to think like. That's how they teach us to think in government schools and government propaganda, that it's okay in war to bomb this group of this population of innocent civilians over here because, you know, they make ball bearings or whatever, and those are used in war. Well, that's collectivist thinking, and anarchists have to reject that. No, just because somebody works for government, they are not a target. Just because somebody is employed by government, just because they're an agent of the government in some way, that does not make them a target. You are not justified in striking representatives of the government in any way simply because the government is aggressive. Of course the government is aggressive. Of course we're in self-defense mode. But think of it on an individual basis, not a collective basis. Striking an individual government worker on any level simply because they're the government is against the zero aggression principle, and it's against what anarchists should stand for. Just to beat this dead horse a little bit more, like I've said, you know, how many times? A million times? I don't know, that's an exaggeration. But I've said it over and over that the government is not our enemy. The government is not the enemy of anarchists. The religion of the state, the belief, the faith in the state that justifies government, that's our enemy. When people think of what the government is doing, when they think of what government agents are doing, and they think in their mind, well, I may not like that, but that's what has to be done for the better of society. That myth, that belief, that's our enemy. It's not the actual people in government that are doing this. Well, there are individuals in government that are doing it. I'm not trying to take the responsibility away from the individuals. But I'm saying it's that faith in the state that justifies them doing that to themselves, justifies the in their own minds them doing these things. So that's what we have to fight, the myth of the state. Now, I wanted to talk about cloaking a little bit. I mentioned our ability to cloak our activities. Now, this is I'm talking about, what did I call it, the Lego distribution network. Within the Lego distribution network, we need to be as cloaked as possible. Is that a proper way of saying that? Ways that we can cloak ourselves. Well, you think about a car driving down the road. You're in your car, and one of the things that cops love to do is they love to spot a car with a license plate light out, or with one tail light out, or with one brake light out. If you are in this Lego distribution network and you're riding in a car, every proper light on that car should be functioning. Every license plate light, tail lights, headlights, running lights, every light on that car should be functional. You need clean, like your back seat, clean, no clutter, not a bunch of junk in there. Nice clean floors, not a bunch of junk. Windows that are not dark tinted, you know, maybe a little tint to keep the sun out, but not dark tinted, you know, heavily blacked out windows. You need to have valid registration in the vehicle, valid insurance papers, up-to-date license for the driver, identification for all the occupants. The cop pulls you over for whatever reason. You're super helpful. You're super polite. You're seemingly, you have nothing to hide as far as the cop can tell. The cop wants to look in your trunk. You have nothing in your trunk. You have nothing there whatsoever. Sure, officer. I don't mind at all. Check my trunk. No bumper stickers on the car. No anarchist signs. No pot symbols. None of that kind of stuff. If you want stickers on a car that's being used in the Lego distribution network, if you want to put bumper stickers on that car, put the Happy Family bumper stickers with like the dad and the mom and the three kids and the dog. Or Terry with a soccer ball or the happy cheerleader stickers, that kind of thing. If you have to have a sticker on a vehicle that's being used in the Lego distribution network, it needs to look like the family minivan or whatever. It doesn't need to look in any way suspicious to a cop. So that if by some chance, if by some freak occurrence, you're driving down the street and you're involved in an accident somehow, and the cops show up, you look like any other Tom, Dick, or Harry that's going across town. You don't want in any way to appear to be unusual. Your style of clothing should fit in with your surroundings, fit in with the other people. If you're on the beach, if you're in near a resort area, you're wearing goofy-looking Bermuda shorts and a flowery shirt or whatever. You don't want to be wearing a trench coat in Florida, okay? Don't draw attention to yourselves like that. No 420 shirts, no, you know, Gadsden flags, none of that kind of thing. No visible gun bulges anywhere on you. Now take a look at the picture of me. You see my hair. You see my beard. The underground network people cannot look like this. I look like something that a cop would want to talk to, cop would want to pull over, a cop would want to question. The people within the Lego distribution network cannot look like what I look like. They need to look like Barack Obama. They need to look like, I'm trying to think of one of these, Harry Reid. They need to look like that. They need to look like a bank teller. They need to look like a school teacher. They need to not look like me. Now this is, and I'm not saying that anarchists have to look a certain way. What I'm saying is, if you're involved in the Lego distribution network that I'm talking about, if you're one of the people putting Legos in the dark, in the hallway, in the dark, then you need to look like everybody else around you, and your car needs to look like every other car on the highway. You need to blend in. And I hate to say this, but it's really important. I know I have Muslim listeners. There needs to be no Muslims in the underground anarchist movement in the Western world, because Muslims are already unjustifiably targets. They are already susceptible to persecution by the governments, especially the United States government, but it's the same thing in England, the same thing all across Europe. Muslims are already susceptible to being harassed, being arrested for no reason, to having their lives upset and turned upside down, because there's already so much bigotry against Muslims in the Western world. So if you're a Muslim and you're an anarchist and you feel like you need to do something, work in the above ground anarchist movement. Don't be involved. Don't be connected in any way with the underground, because they will get you. They will seek you. They will go after your family, because that's the kind of enemy we're dealing with. That's the way the governments are, especially in the West. I wanted to just mention too that, you know, in the last episode of this, I should have said this to start with. If you're listening to this and you haven't heard the first two episodes, I mean this. Shut this off now. Go to badquaker.com, download the first two episodes, and listen to them sequentially. Do not come into this halfway through and expect it to make any sense, okay? Because it's going to be jarbled. And I'm going to sound crazy to you is what it's going to sound like. So seriously, shut this podcast off. Go back to badquaker.com, download the first two episodes of this series on going beyond civil disobedience. Download those, listen to them sequentially before you get to this one. Okay, now, anyway, in the last episode on this topic, I talked about violence that was within the zero aggression principle and violence that was outside the zero aggression principle. And we need to keep these things in mind, and we need to refine them and work among ourselves to determine, is this action within the zero aggression principle? Is this action outside of the zero aggression principle? And if it's outside of the zero aggression principle, it doesn't matter how tempting it is, and it doesn't matter what it seems like the result is going to be. Reject it. If it's outside the zero aggression principle, we have to reject it, because the long-term process is only going to reward that which is within the zero aggression principle, and we will be punished for any activity outside the zero aggression principle, because that's how natural law works. So there's four things that anarchists should be doing, and these are in levels of priority. The number one priority thing that anarchists should be doing is educating people on the evils of government. This is the moral argument. We need to show people the moral argument. The number two thing we need to do is point out the failures of government. When government fails to do the things that they claim the exclusive right to do, this is the practical argument. The number two most important thing that we should be doing is expressing the practical argument. The number one thing is the moral argument. Number two thing is the practical argument. The third most important thing that we should be doing is earning money for ourselves and our families. As much as possible, earn money from the failures of government. And I talked about that in the last episode. If you can sell a $700 hammer to the government that you paid 39 cents for, then get a bucket load of them, get a truckload of them. Make as much money off of the failures of government as possible. And the fourth most important thing, the bottom thing on the rung, is assisting the government in its path of self-destruction. It's putting out the Legos in the hall at night. That's the least most important thing. It will have to be done. At some point, our hand is going to be forced, and we're going to have to take on nose-to-nose the government. But at this point, the fourth most important thing, the least most important thing to the anarchist, is spreading the Legos in the dark. Okay, when I get back from this break, we'll get into this a little bit more in depth. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial break. Now, in the last episode, I talked about Sinn Féin and the Irish Republican Army and how the two entities in every way appeared to be unconnected, and yet they were really one thing. And this is exactly how the anarchist movement has to be. Our above-ground image has to be flawless. It has to be innocent. And the underground has to be, there has to be a plausible deniability. And I went back and listened to the last episode, and I actually kept saying that backwards. I kept saying deniable plausibility. Hopefully you heard it in the right direction. I meant to say plausible deniability, but I just said it backwards. Anyway, our public image has to be no harmful than, I talked before about Robin Hood of Keene. These are the folks that go around and put coins in traffic, in parking meters to keep people from getting tickets. And then they put a little card on the windshield that says, hey, we helped you out there. That's the kind of image that we need. That we need programs like that in every city. We need people going out, putting cards on windshields and putting quarters in parking machines and saving people money. That's how we win a good reputation. Our actual actions, though, the underground actions that we're talking about in this series, need to be more like Fight Club. And if you're unfamiliar with the movie Fight Club, I'm sorry, watch it and learn. Keep this in mind, too, and I said this before in the other podcast, no one acts alone. No one acts alone. Acting alone ends up taking you down a path where you are almost guaranteed at some point you're going to go astray and you're going to wander in to violating the zero aggression principle. So no one acts alone, and yet everyone acts alone. Anyone who is actually exposed and faces the complete anger of government, in every way, it has to appear that they're alone. And this is why I was saying in a previous podcast that the underground activist, the Lego distributor, those people have to be unencumbered by family connections and personal possessions. Those people that I'm talking about, these people within the Lego distribution network, the underground activists, they need to be unencumbered by family members and by personal possessions. You have to be ready at any moment just to get up from where you are, pop out the window. Well, first grab your bug out bag, pop out the window, connect with the network, and be in Cleveland or be in Baltimore or be in Seattle within a little period of time. Completely abandon whatever is there and get out. You need to have that kind of mobility. You need to not have close family members that government officials can just pick them up, hold them, and then let you know, hey, you come in or face whatever we're going to do to your family members. Now, people in, in the former Soviet Union, people in the former Eastern Bloc in Europe, people in China today, people in North Korea, they already know this rule. They already understand this, and they already know that governments will do this. Governments turn to this on a regular basis. They will snatch up your family members. They will threaten you through your family members. So the underground activist has to be unencumbered by these things. We also, for this to work, now, like I said, we're in a very small window of time when we can prepare for this. For this process to work, we have to have secure lines of communications. We have to have them established, and we have to have them maintained. Currently, as things are today, we have available things like software, like Pigeon, like BitMessage. We have several different kinds of encrypted email that we can utilize. There are ways, there are technologies that we can use secure telephones. I'm going to not get into that probably in this series, but there are available today secure telephones that you can buy. They're not cheap, but if we had, at least one in every major grouping of anarchists that could be utilized. But these cannot fall into the wrong hands. We have to be very careful with these because once the network is compromised, every phone on that network is then compromised. And I know I'm being a little bit vague here, but I can get into that on another time. It's imperative to assume, do this today. What I'm saying is an absolute rule that all of us have to adhere to today. Assume every unsecured phone call, every text, every email, any other type of communication like that. Today, assume that it's being recorded because a good likelihood is that it is being recorded. Currently, a lot of companies, if you're on a company computer, a lot of companies have software already installed on the computers that record their keystrokes. Where I worked at in the aerospace industry, we knew this. This was 10, 12 years ago. We understood that everything you typed on your computer was being recorded by keystroke software. We understood that then. Of course, I was in a secure area of, military, within the military industrial complex. But we understood that then, and it's more so now. Lots of companies record the keystrokes of their employees. Lots of companies record every site that you go to when you're on a company computer. So you need to be aware of this. There is developing, some of it already exists, but there's more. There's better software developing right now that governments use to look for what they call problematic phrases. We have to be aware of these kind of things. If you're using something like Facebook, if you're using any other kind of popular, communication device like that, then you need to be aware that there's software that searches that constantly looking for these problematic phrases. Pretty soon, if it's not already happening, pretty soon Google is going to be reporting these problematic phrases, that pop up in searches. Like I say, if they're not already, there's a good possibility they're already reporting these the results of these searches like that. Now, here is an opportunity for above ground activism. Those of us who are safe, those of us who are clean, those of us who are not involved in any way with any kind of violent or any kind of underground activism, we can combat problematic phrase situation. We can combat that by flooding the internet with the 377 keywords that government computers watch for. There's an activist named Meg McLean, and she's brilliant. And she has a website where she put up an online terrorist keyword poetry contest. Online terrorist keyword poetry contest. I'll put a link in today's show notes for that. And the idea is to flood the internet with so many of these keyword phrases that the government's searches are useless. These 377 keywords, if they are so common on the internet, if they're mingled into so many communications on Facebook and so many websites and so many blog entries and so many forum entries that the government just is overwhelmed with them. This is like pouring molasses into, you know, into the gears of, well, maybe not. No, this is more of a monkey rant. Well, no, it's more like molasses. I'll argue these weird little points here with myself. But either way, this is an activity that the above ground activists can do. So long as they keep themselves safe. You don't want to be using all these keywords if there's any reason at all that you can be arrested. I'm thinking here recently, and I'm not going to be too specific, but I'm thinking here recently of activists that were arrested when, you know, if the government had been a little bit more efficient in their work, those activists who were arrested could have been in really serious problems because what they had at home. And people who know what I'm talking about know what I'm talking about. If you're going to do activism and put yourself out in front of the government's face through open, above-ground activism, you need to be clean. Your house needs to be clean. Your car needs to be clean. Otherwise, you set yourself up for arrest for, you know, for problem A. They come to your house. They find problem B. Now you got a bigger charge on your hands. Okay, so I hope that wasn't too vague. We need to know our enemy, and we need to know ourselves. Know your enemy. Know that modern government requires control of the money supply, control of the media, complacency of the public, and a permanent state of war with a military that's willing to turn on the public. Know your enemy. Know also that the final stage of the state that's still to come is going to be the unification of the nations under, I'm thinking, probably three governing bodies worldwide. When this begins to take place, when this unification begins to take place, the state will be at the most vulnerable position it's been in since the days of Jericho. Since the very birth of the state has had a lot of insulators to keep it viable, even when at times it seemed like the state was going to vanish off the face of the earth. But I'm saying to you that, and I just don't have time to get into it in this series. It's going to have to be a theology-based one that's going to have to come in another series. But based on history, based on theology, I'm saying that the state is going to attempt to consolidate the nations of the world into one worldwide nation state. Before that happens, it will probably come into about three worldwide nation states. And as this takes place, the state will be at its most vulnerable that it's ever been since its inception. And this is why we have to prepare. This is why we have to be in a position where we can fight back when we need to. But right now we can fight by using alternative currencies, alternative markets of every kind, alternative markets in as many things as possible. Food, I'm thinking, is probably one of the most important things to have an alternative market for, because that's one of the ways that the government really historically are really successful in manipulating people, by manipulating the food supply. So alternative currencies, alternative markets in everything. We need to create and store real wealth, hard, tangible items that the government can't tax and can't touch and can't find. In the meantime, we need to bleed the government in every way possible within the zero aggression principle. Anything you can do, you know, sell them those $700 hammers. Everything you can do, bleed the government through a million tiny cuts. The other thing I mentioned was turning the government against itself. Remember that picture of the firefighters against the riot police in Spain? That was on the last episode on badquaker.com in the show notes. That's what has to come about. We have to see a point of where the government is turning on itself, and it will. The government eats its own. They always do throughout history. When it gets desperate, it begins eating its own. And especially those who are most vulnerable to the government, the people in inner cities, the poor, those people who are dependent upon the government mostly for food and for their living, those people are, the government is going to turn on them and devour them. So we need to not be in the way when that happens. And if you find yourself in those kind of situations, have a method to get out. Have a way to extract yourself from those situations. We need public outreach charity, education, all of this is critical above ground work. This is the stuff that the above ground network has to be doing. Charity outreach, like I was talking about, dropping quarters and meters, things like that. But we also need the monkey wrenches, the Legos. We need that too. We need that, the molasses, to slow government down in every way. One thing is critical though, is that we, avoid direct confrontation. This is most important to the underground people, to a lesser extent with the above ground, but it's critical with the underground work that we avoid direct confrontation with the government in any way. You know, I'm thinking of the Homer effect, or the Homer method, maybe. Homer Simpson on the TV show Simpsons, one time he says that the American way is to just do a really crappy job. And this is critical. If you work within government, if you work for something that supports government, don't feel bad about that. You can be useful by just doing a really crappy job constantly. Just pour that molasses right in there and just slow everything down. Everything that comes across your desk, do it slowly, do it poorly, do a really crappy job of everything. Here's a story that goes way back in my life. When I was 19, I was hired in a really nasty chemical factory, just not far outside of Death Valley. It was a really miserable place to work. It was horrible heat. We were a good portion of the factory was inside metal buildings with really super high humidity because there was a lot of steam and a lot of evaporation taking place. And so you've got, Death Valley-like heat and steam and humidity on top of that. And it was just a horrible, miserable, dangerous place to work. And early on working there, I ended up staying there 8 years. I don't know how I did that, but early on, I noticed this guy, this old guy, and I would see him sometimes, and I'd think, man, that guy's a real worker. He's always busy. Because I would see him, and he had this really big wrench, like an open-end wrench, and it was probably about, I'm going to say, probably 30 inches long or so. And it was probably, the actual wrench part was probably about a 2 2 1/4, 2 1/8, something like that size, a wrench opening on the end. And he would have that over his shoulder, holding on to it with it over his shoulder, and he'd be walking at a really fast pace across the chemical plant, just walking, like walking down one of the streets in the chemical plant. And he would always be going really fast, and he always had this look on his face like he was really angry or really upset. And you would see this guy. I found out his name was Art Sepulveda, and you'd see Art, just beat-feeting it across the plant, trying to get wherever it was he was supposed to be getting to, and you'd think, oh man, look how busy Art is. And here's the tricky part. Management would see Art, and they would say, oh, there's Art Sepulveda. He's always doing a good job. See, he's going somewhere important right now. And so there's Art with that wrench over his shoulder. Boy, he's just going as fast as he could. Years later, I got to know Art Sepulveda, and Art was a great guy. And he, what he actually did was about once or twice a week, he would do all the work he had to do. And he would do that within a couple hours. And the whole rest of the week, he would hang out. He had hiding places. He'd hide over here. He'd hide over there. He'd go socialize over here. He'd go socialize over there. And a couple times a day, he'd throw that wrench over his shoulder, and he'd get a scowl on his face, and he'd take off across the plant as fast as he could walk. And he'd make rounds like that. And the whole purpose, the way he walked, the direction he would walk, the routes that he would take through the plant, it was all for maximum visibility so that management could see him, and so that he would give the appearance to management that he was a go-getter, that he was really doing his job, and that he was in a big hurry and he couldn't be disturbed. So nobody in management would call over Art and say, hey, Art, drop whatever you're doing. I got this job for you. They wouldn't do that because you could tell by the look on his face. He was serious. He had something he had to get to. And what he had to get to was another break. Art Sepulveda was a genius people working in government, people working in support of government, companies that support government, aerospace, defense industry, companies doing that. Be Art Sepulveda. Be Homer Simpson. Do a really crappy job. Keep your job. Don't get fired. Don't, you know, if you can stand the job, keep it. Bleed money out of the government. Exchange as much of those dollars into preparations of different kinds. You know, the old thing is bullets, beans, and Band-Aids. Convert as much of that as possible into real item, as much wealth as possible, into tangible things, gold, silver, stuff like this. Drain as much wealth as we can get out of government. But don't abandon your government job. Don't abandon your government support job. Just be Art Sepulveda. Okay, when I get back from the break, I'm going to tell another story about a guy named George Stone from that same chemical plant that I used to work at. Stick with me. I'll be right back. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. So I promised another story about the chemical plant that I worked at. And this place was nasty. It was a good portion of the chemical plant was built in the 1920s and the 1930s during the Depression. So it was really run down. It was in really bad shape. Several of the buildings, the roofs had rusted completely off. So you would have the walls of the building with either no roof at all or only partial roof. And inside there was all these big machines that you know, they were like something out of a sci-fi movie or something. A lot of the stuff built back in the 20s and 30s, and it was a really nasty place to work. There was a guy there named George Stone that I worked with very closely and became very good friends with George. And no relation. We both had the last name Stone, but there was no relation whatsoever. But George was a great guy. He was, the true hippie type. I mean, he had his hair probably was almost down to his belt line in the back. And, he had spent time in prison and the whole nine yards. And George was a really smart guy. And he would do things like, so here's a phrase from George. He said, you know, this is in reference to fighting against the system in useful ways. He would say, don't piss in the king's well, piss in his cup. Or he'd say, piss in his soup. Don't piss in the king's well, piss in his soup. That was a thing that George Stone would say. And I've kept that in my mind all these years. You know, you don't want to do something that's going to – you think of the king's house. You think of the king's a mansion or whatever, and you're a servant. You're stuck in there. You have no real choice. You have to do this. And so you don't want to piss in the king's well because all of the servants are drinking out of that same well. But the king's soup is a different thing altogether. You see, we have to think of ways that we can attack the system without harming the rest of the people that are stuck, that have no choice, that we're stuck within the system. So we don't want to do anything to harm the king's household. Okay, and I won't get more specific than that. I do have another story, though, that comes to me from my days in working there in the chemical plant. Eventually, working there long enough, I became a stationary steam engineer and worked with big boilers and cooling towers. And there was a lot of laboratory work that had to be done. We had to test the water. We had different kinds of chemical tests that we had to constantly do on the cooling towers and on the boiler water and the steam and so forth. And we had a real nice control room. When I became a stationary steam engineer, I was no longer working out there in the really bad, nasty part of the chemical plant. Now I was inside of a nice laboratory setting. We had, real nice, control room. And, we're using test tubes and we're different chemicals and we're testing water and we're testing steam and we're doing all these kind of things. But there was a problem. We had, there were maintenance people that would, be outside of our control room and outside of our laboratory, and they would be working on different things. And when we would go out to take our samples and abandon the laboratory, they would come in and they would go through the refrigerators and take our lunches. and steal our sandwiches or steal our food or whatever, steal any candy bars that we had in our lunch or whatever like that. They would do this pretty regularly. They would also, if we had we had a coffee maker there, and we would have fresh coffee so that we could, you know, drink coffee throughout the day. And they would come in, like 8 or 10 of them would come in and empty our coffee and, you know, and not make another batch. They would just drink up all of our coffee, eat our lunches, and then they'd leave. So we figured out a way to combat this. We, all of us in the lab, agreed on this. We all understood, it was all within all of us. We knew what we were doing. We very carefully baited a very nice lunch in the refrigerator and the coffee pot, we had this chemical that we used in testing, and it's a harmless chemical, harmless in the sense of long-term harmless. It's called phenolphthalein. And you use it as a color indicator in some of the tests that we were using in testing our boiler water and our cooling water and so forth. And phenolphthalein is also used in zoos as a laxative for elephants and rhinos. You with me? So we just very carefully, a very controlled amount of phenolphthalein went into a baited lunch and went into the coffee pot. And we did that, and then we left the room, and we let the maintenance guys come in and have and steal our lunch. We let them steal our lunch, and we let them drink up all of our coffee. And then it was some time before we started having problems with the maintenance crew coming in and stealing our lunch again. So once again, we agreed to a time, we agreed to a day. And then we all abandoned, we set up a baited lunch with a baited pot of coffee, and we left, and the maintenance crew came in again. And we didn't have any more problems with the maintenance crew after that. We didn't, they weren't, you know, they weren't long-term, they weren't harmed. But for about a day, they felt the effects of the phenolphthalein, which is, like I said, we used it for the purpose of testing. But zoos use it as a laxative for elephants and rhinos. So without getting any further into that subject. Now, if you can imagine similar activities in regards to the state, we can bait the state. I should say the government. We can bait the government into stealing our lunch. We can bait the government into drinking our coffee. We can put those Legos out. There's a book called Don't Get Mad, Get Even, The Big Book of Revenge by George Hayduke. And this was recommended to me by one of the listeners that I communicate with on Facebook. And he said, check this out. And I went over and I took a look and I started reading it. And I thought, holy cow, this guy's a genius. There's a lot of disclaimers in this book. But still, it's very interesting. But he says something in this. Hayduke says something in this. He says, the one thing the establishment is prepared for is a violent frontal attack. Now, I'm going to repeat that because it's important. The one thing the establishment is prepared for is a violent frontal attack. They may be pure lard on the inside, but they've got 24 inches of armor plate in the front. We have to avoid a frontal attack when it comes to dealing with government. We have to avoid a frontal attack. It's how the enemy expects to be attacked. They expect things like a march on Washington, D.C. That's exactly what the government wants. That's exactly what they expect. That's behavior they know how to deal with. That's behavior that comes right in their book, as in expect protesters to do this. They expect that. They're prepared for it. They're designed to handle it. But there's lard on the other side of that wall. There's lard on the other side of that armor plating. We need to never let your enemy know that you are the enemy. Think about that. Never attack the enemy the way the enemy expects, and never allow the enemy to know that you're the enemy. That's how the underground aspects of this have to work. That's how the Lego distribution network has to function. Anarchists should not follow the path of organizations like Earth First, the Earth Liberation, Earth Liberation Front, ELF, E-L-F, Earth Liberation Front, and the Animal Liberation Front. We should, or the IRA. We should not use those organizations as our example on how to behave. We should not be thinking of ways to, you know, I don't know if Earth First actually did it or not, but they were accused of putting spikes in trees to try to damage the lumberjacks' equipment and possibly even harm the lumberjacks. We need to not in any way do things like that that can randomly hurt people. That is the exact opposite of the direction we need to go. This activity like that created hatred toward Earth First. Like when ELF, I believe ELF was the ones that set the car dealerships on fire. You see, you're not making friends. You're not winning people's hearts and minds by setting a car dealership on fire. That is the absolute opposite of what we need to be doing. You know, throwing blood at people, stuff like that, like some of the animal rights organizations have done. This does not win you friends. This does not win the hearts and minds of people. What this does is it puts you on a radar, and it will guarantee the kind of attention that we just don't need. We need to avoid that kind of attention. We need to avoid infiltration. We need to avoid centralization. Think of the lesson that should be learned by the bombing of Judy, I think her name is Barry, probably Barry. Anyway, she was a big shot in Earth First. And the FBI set her up, and they probably used some stooges from a different organization that probably wasn't actually FBI agents that did it. But one way or the other, the FBI, their hand was all over this. Barry. Anyway, she was in San Francisco or Oakland, I can't remember which, and she was going to drive across town, and she was actually going to go to a meeting where they were going to talk about peaceable demonstrations. And while she was driving across town in her car, a bomb blew up underneath her seat and almost killed her and the other occupant that was with her, another Earth First member. Then the FBI arrested her, claiming that it was her bomb and that she was transporting the bomb that accidentally exploded. Now, later forensics proved that the bomb had a motion sensor detonator. And I mean, why would you, if you made a bomb, had a little interruption there, so I'm not sure exactly where to pick that back up at. But anyway, the FBI accused Judy Barry, I'm assuming that's how you pronounce her name, of transporting, of making and transporting a bomb in her car, and they made the assumption or the accusation that it accidentally exploded. But if you did make a bomb, if you did that, and if you knew you were going to transport the bomb, you wouldn't arm the bomb and with a motion sensor detonator and then put it in your car under the seat you're riding in and drive across town. You wouldn't do that. I don't know of anybody that would be that dumb to do that. So, you know, just on the surface, that's ridiculous. She didn't do that. And then later on, there was actually a different organization that took credit for that bomb and another bomb that was blamed on Earth First. And that other organization was, one of these puppet stooge organizations that the FBI had pretty much completely infiltrated. So that and the fact that the BATF was supposed to be the ones that investigated this bomb, right? Because that's what they do. But the FBI pulled rank on them and wouldn't let the BATF investigate the explosion. And eventually all the charges against her were dropped, and a lawsuit, I can't remember who the lawsuit was against, but she won the lawsuit, basically, proving that, well, and in addition to that, no bomb making material was found, because of course immediately the cops come in and search everybody's homes that was associated with her, the place that she had just been prior to that. Everybody gets everything searched. They didn't find any bomb-making material. Of course they didn't, because the bomb didn't originate with the Earth First People. But that's beside the point. You see, she had drawn attention to herself by putting together a very effective network and by putting together a very effective organization, Earth First. And in doing that, and being public about it, and in the activities that took place surrounding Earth First, she drew the attention of not only the FBI, but of the big money that was backing the logging industry at that time in that location in Northern California. So you've upset big money people, and you're upsetting the government at the same time. You put yourself on the radar, you've drawn a big target on your forehead, and then don't be shocked when the FBI does something like this to you, because that's what they do. That's the FBI has had a reputation of doing that for as long as there's been an FBI. And I mentioned infiltration. There's a problem with infiltration. Oftentimes, fear of infiltration can be as harmful as infiltration itself. If you look at some activities that have gone on within the Liberty Movement, specifically up in New Hampshire in the Free State Project, there has been attempts of infiltration, and there may have been infiltration. There may be today infiltration in the Free State Project, but oftentimes fear of that infiltration causes division among friends to the point of where the fear of the infiltration is more harmful than the infiltration. This is especially true if everybody keeps themselves clean in the above ground activism. If everybody in the above ground activism keeps themselves clean, it doesn't matter if you're infiltrated. It doesn't matter, because you're not doing anything wrong. You're not doing anything illegal. So infiltration should be expected. But in the underground aspects of this, you have to absolutely be invisible. Therefore, there's nothing for them to infiltrate, because they don't know you exist. You see how easy that is to stop infiltration? You just don't have a visible presence. And then the government won't know how to infiltrate you, because they won't know who you are. There's a really great discussion that's on YouTube between Robert Anton Wilson and Carl Hess. And they're talking about their adventures through the 70s and 60s, 70s, and 80s. I believe it's at a libertarian convention, like recorded probably in the 80s, but they talk about how infiltrated their groups were back in the 60s and 70s, and how serious the infiltration was, and how the government infiltrators would even be ratting out each other because there were so many of them in the organization. And I'll put a link in today's show notes to that video. It's a really good video. It's like an hour. I think it's over an hour long, maybe an hour and 20 minutes or something like that. But it's a really good video. And if you don't have time for that, if you follow the link to YouTube and then open the notes that are down below where the actual YouTube video is on the YouTube page, if you open the notes there, in the notes for that video, there's a link to the audio-only version of that. So you don't have to just sit at the computer and stare at YouTube. You can download the audio and listen to it on your MP3 player or whatever. And keep in mind, you know, we're talking about infiltration. Keep in mind that anybody who's vulnerable can be compromised by the government. Anybody who's in a position where you know a lot of things, if you're in a position where you know a lot of things that are going on in the movement, then you're going to be a target for government compromise. There's what I was talking about earlier, you know, the encumbrances of life, family, finances, possessions. If you are a person that the government feels knows a lot of information, or if the government thinks you're one of the people who can connect between the above ground and the underground, if the government thinks you're one of those people, then you're going to be targeted. They're going to attempt to compromise you. They're going to attempt to either entice you or threaten you or incarcerate you, because this is what they do. It's just how they act. It's what they do. For this reason, action groups need the underground action groups need to be as small as possible. and they need to be very familiar with each other. There needs to be, you need to be extremely careful with anyone new coming in. Thinking of that video with Hess and Wilson, you know, government, as it's burdened with all of the things that it promises it can do for people, government begins to grind on itself. And we see this when, you know, like recently the IRS was dumped on by government with, that's the Internal Revenue Service, the tax arm of the United States government. The IRS was dumped on by the rest of government by throwing the burdens of Obama, of enforcing Obamacare onto the IRS. So the IRS is having to massively readjust itself. They're trying to put together IRS SWAT teams. They're trying to train IRS agents to do things that they've never had to do before. They're creating whole new divisions of the IRS to try to handle all the burdens that Obamacare is going to dump on them. So the IRS right now, today, is almost ground to a halt because it's got so much more junk that it has to do. Well, back to this video with Hess and Wilson. They, in the video, they have a crazy suggestion that I found hilarious. Fake tax forms. To flood the IRS with fake tax forms. Again, you know, like molasses in the engine of government. Fake, and they didn't mention this, but another thing that could be easily done is fake arrest records for government or media officials, Photoshop scandals anonymously leaked across the internet, things like this. And this is where the hacker community can really help our goals. We as anarchists need to embrace the hacker community, and we have so much to share with them, and they have so much to share with us that there, you know, it's a logical marriage between anarchists and hackers. I can't go into that deeply enough today because of time restraints, but this is a marriage that has to take place. The marriage of theoretical anarchy, of the philosophical anarchy that we play with above ground here. And the whole hacker community, they need to understand us, and we need to understand them, and their ability to get into government and alter arrest records, alter tax forms, you know, file 10,000 or 100,000 or 100 million tax forms electronically in a 24-hour period, things like that, that can just dump molasses into the engines, into the engine of government, things like that, that can pour phenolphthalein into the coffee of government. We need more and more and more of that. Be sure and catch the next episode in this series. And thanks for listening today. And remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks.